Well, how could a nuclear meltdown on the shore of the Pacific not be scary to Alaskans? But can we define that a bit? Are we scared of the right things? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We can expect a deluge of phone calls today. And make note of the number now if you want to be one of them. Statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Risk from Fukushima radiation is the subject on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska's public schools have new standards in English and math, setting high expectations for students. Students who meet these goals will be ready for success after high school, whether in the military, on the job, or in an apprenticeship, technical school, or college. Ask your school for parent guides to the standards or learn more online at education.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So on March 11, 2011, the nuclear power plants along the coast in Japan were subject to a tidal wave that caused a lot of destruction and a release into the atmosphere. And in fact, even these years later, there continues to be problems securing the location at Fukushima, as we all know, and as everyone speculates about endlessly. So it's time to do a call-in show on it, and I cast about for who to talk to and came up with Doug Dasher, who I've known for many years because he's been the state's radiation guy. He's the radiation guy for Project Chariot, the radiation guy for Amchica, looking at the residual radiation there. And he's now a research professional, you call yourself, Doug, at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which essentially involves a laboratory where you look for radiation, right?
Yeah, that's just one of the things. We do have a laboratory where we do analysis for radionuclides, and then we also continue to work with the Department of Environmental Conservation in regards to the Amchitka underground nuclear test site.
And so this this little laboratory here was recently, the work was shown at the Marine Science Symposium last week, in which you and Dr. Kelly, Dr. John Kelly, and some others put forward some results from a sampling of tissues of marine mammals who were in the unusual mortality event, which actually followed the Fukushima. So I wanted to immediately get you on that subject as to what you found when you started looking at those tissues.
Yeah, basically when we looked at those tissues, you're correct, they were from the 2011 unusual mortality event. We were looking at cesium-137 as the marker and cesium-134, which are two radionuclides that were released at Fukushima in large quantities and sort of markers for indicating Fukushima radiation in the environment. And what we found was basically the levels in the samples that we took from a control and for some of the seals that were ill. Now, these had been necropsied and were sent in and handled through the veterinarian. And we worked closely with the North Slope Borough and one of the veterinarians up there, Rafael Stamara, on getting these samples and collecting them. We found basically that levels were not exceedingly high. They were comparable to samples that were taken back in the late 1990s during the Arctic Nuclear Waste Assessment Program, which was looking tasked to look at the dumping of Russian reactors into the Kara and Barents Sea, released down the rivers in Russia. So there's a large effort back in the early and late 90s looking at both subsistence foods in Alaska, looking at transport of radionuclides across the Arctic. and also doing risk analysis of those radionuclides in food. And as part of that, there were ringed and bearded seals sampled back in the 1960s, so we had comparable levels to look at from that period of time for cesium-137. Though we didn't do plutonium, which was an issue from the dumped reactors and things in the ocean, those tissues back in the 1990s also had plutonium run on those, which essentially showed global atmospheric fallout input of plutonium from nuclear testing days in those tissues. But we have not really run plutonium due to the cost, and we're not capable of doing it up here. It usually requires almost one of the national labs anymore to do the low-level plutonium work up on tissues. But we looked mainly at cesium-137 and found that level comparable to what you saw in the mid-1990s. And these were seals that, of course, been off of the ice for a while, obviously, to feeding in those periods. When the seals were on the ice, the other thing we tried to address was, well, what was their exposure when they were actually up on the ice, when you had fallout coming down from the atmospheric release at Fukushima in that early period in March and April for that. And we looked at deposition models from around the world that were generated by, you know, different universities and laboratories, looking at what could be the amount of cesium-137 say falling over the Bering Sea. And even looking at that, we found, you know, levels that were higher than what you may see terrestrially or further away from Fukushima inland on the ice. So the levels there we didn't see high enough to directly cause the illnesses that were seen in the seals. What we looked at is what's occurring in Europe and a lot of places is looking at what they call multiple stressors, where an animal or human could be impacting, you know, climate change, you have contaminants, your food supply may be changing, so the body's under stress. And then you add another chemical, be it radiation or another insult like temperature changes and that, then that can cause illnesses in the population.
So, in other words, the bottom line is that it wouldn't have been a smoking gun, but it could have been a factor along with other stressors.
Yeah, that's what we found for the ice scenario when the seals were on ice. The problem being is we can look at that as a scenario, but the ice melted. There was no sampling or anything occurring out on the ice or up in that region at that time.
As far as we can go is to speculate that there's
other work still looking at viruses, at bacteria. And I'm not directly involved, but so far I don't believe they've been able to come up with a direct link to anything to at the moment.
Right. Well, I noticed in our comment thread when we put out our website advance notice about this program, people immediately started commenting. One comment I got that I found perplexing was saying, well, this unusual mortality event is still going on. I don't believe that's factually correct because I've talked to the investigating scientists quite a bit, and as far as I know, it kind of went away just as it arrived as a mystery.
Yeah, I do know that there's a local environmental observer network, and I do know people within the UME are aware of things. I don't think that they've agreed or seen that the what's being seen in that network necessarily relates directly back to the original disease types that they saw back in 2011. But that said, that's, you know, something for them to look at if, tissues are presented to them for that.
Absolutely. And so, we're talking with Doug Dasher. He's a researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Science. And he was for many years with the Department of Environmental Conservation looking at radiation monitoring, radiation threats, radiation incidents. He was the go-to guy. And Doug, I wanted to, you mentioned the 1990s assessment of the really colossal amount of nuclear waste, submarines scuttled, reactors just dumped in the water that occurred off the Russian coast in the Arctic. And how that gave rise to some concerns. I remember there was, I think it was a Dr. Golovkin, who did quite a large assessment of this, and the state got concerned. And as I recall, the result was they said, well, gosh, you know, not all that much ever showed up here.
Yeah, that was the thing. A lot of the dumping, of course, it didn't occur in the burying, you know, the seas. There were some things down in Kamchatka with the nuclear sub-facilities and some lost sources. Most of it was over in the European Arctic where it occurred, and then it was mixed into the water and transported through the water. And, of course, the Bering Straits, and that the water is flowing into the Arctic principally rather than running out of the Arctic and then comes out over by Greenland. So there wasn't a route that was carrying a huge amount of radionuclides that would have been released over time. Realized much of the stuff was not going to occur immediately. The reactors were covered with this material that would slow down any release that they dumped on the seabed floor. So, yeah, the levels are low in Alaska waters, almost comparable to atmospheric fallout from the 1960s was the main component seen. But there was a large effort to collect specimens and samples and then actually work with the subsistence community and do dietary assessments of risk. And the risks were very low. They're never zero, but, you know, 1 in 1 million, 1 in 10 million, things like that, chances for cancer and that. So when they were looking at that, yeah, they found the levels around Alaska were extremely low. Fukushima, on the other case, was one that would actually generate levels that would get back potentially to global fallout levels in the Gulf. Not saying what the levels, nobody's, you know, I haven't seen any good modeled estimates for the Bering Sea, which will occur later in time than the Gulf of Alaska, but had much more bearing on concerns in Alaska than actually it was found to be the Russian dumping after a while that just didn't produce the radionuclide input into the region, which we were really lucky.
So we've got modeling, and we see. I think you're telling me that we'll learn more about the plume, the 2011 plume, yeah, in the atmosphere. That we're still learning about that.
Yeah, atmospherically, we know that the plume coming from in March, it first came out of the facility with roughly around the 15th or 16th of March being one of the higher release rates that from Fukushima in 2011 that's been sort of documented in different literature. There's a lot of different literature looking at, well, what were the levels? Obviously, no one was standing out there doing monitoring at the time with all the destruction that went on with the population, the infrastructure, which was cost quite a few lives in the tsunami and things over there. But the estimates were that, you know, the discharge originally came up through the Aleutian Islands atmospherically into the Bering Sea. Some actually went across directly over towards Norway, across the Arctic, and also looped up and went back down through the Aleutians and then on to the west coast. And that was one of the good things with a lot of the atmospheric pathway did not actually head directly straight into the, you know, Anchorage Bowl area or into southeast Alaska at the time. 80% of the atmospheric release, it's estimated, actually went into the ocean, into the North Pacific region, and didn't fall on Japan, which was great when you look at what would happen if the population over there had that 80% that went out to sea, if that actually had wound up terrestrially on land in Japan.
So we had an atmospheric release. It was, you know, definitely of concern, and it traveled over in a matter of really days, and then we had the concern, yeah, about contaminated debris with all sorts of contamination, and including invasive species and all sorts of things that might be attached to stuff that was drifting across the Pacific, and then that what happened next was that the windborne stuff arrived fairly soon. And some of the other stuff is still coming, but it just turned out that outside of maybe some invasive species concerns, that nobody ever found much in the way of any kind of radiation there. Now we've got a situation where the plant has continued to release into the water. And, you know, this has given rise to concerns, especially when people found that there were some tuna all the way to the West Coast in California. that had swum by the location and picked up contamination, and it was found in them there. So this then gave rise to a lot of concern about the whole marine food chain and what has happened if there's still some release that's coming out into the water, the cesium-137 mostly. We're to the point, I guess, now where this diluted cesium has made it all the way to the West Coast. And the problem is that that's all computer models because it's not, there's not enough to measure.
Yeah, there's you know, the various different computer models showing different arrival times depending upon, you know, their guesses, essentially assumptions that they've got to make in the models based upon currents and other information as well as what was actually released. And you're right, you know, there's the atmospheric release, which occurred. One thing that's basically, other than there may still be some small releases there, that's not the concern. The concern is there was a direct discharge to during the early days of the accident in the first couple of months that was fairly significant. And then since then, there's been continuing discharge episodic levels, you know, and not well documented. I must say those levels, though, are quite a bit below what the original levels back in March and April were thought that occurred in the marine environment. So the marine environment off Japan got both the atmospheric deposition that occurred over a widespread area, and again, that was had to be modeled, guessing, looking at weather information, and then a direct discharge from the facility surface water, groundwater, sweeping into the marine environment, and then the currents over there picked that up, and then they carried it, and you wind up in the North Pacific current that then travels over towards the United States, and obviously the debris moved with that same current coming towards the West Coast, and then at about Vancouver region off of there, the current actually splits, and one comes up towards Alaska, eventually becomes the Alaska current component, and the other goes down towards the West Coast and California. And the models have indicated, especially one model that was fairly detailed, that levels would go from less than one disintegration per second for cesium-137 per cubic meter to 20 to 30, potentially, in the section that splits off and comes up along British Columbia and goes to Alaska. And the California would split and potentially have slightly less amounts of radionuclides in it, and also had this other delay in getting it into the coast. Now, these models did not project what you were going to see when you walked out and sampled the surf. They were ocean models and not looking so much at the shelf or estuary areas to estimate when the mixing with, you know, runoff from the rivers and all that occurs. So the levels actually within a coastal bay and that may be much less than these predicted levels. In fact, some models predict one or two disintegrations per second for cesium-137 per cubic meter. So, yeah, there's a range in the models. Arrival time's about the same, sometime between 2013 2015.
Now, with that disintegration per second, what would that register on a Geiger counter, for instance? What does that mean?
I mean, these levels are really low. These are very, very low levels when you're looking at that, you know, the when you get potassium-40 in, you know, marine waters, you've got thousands of becquerels, disintegrations per minute for potassium, for, you know, different uranium species for that in marine water. So you've got a really high background that would mask any of a low level of 10 or 30 becquerels per cubic meter of water.
I got it.
So you're not really going to pick that up with that. You've got and it's the same thing in sampling for fish. Fish generally are said to concentrate from water roughly 100 times what the levels are in water per liter, not per cubic meter, per liter. So you've got to divide that 30 by 1,000 to get down to how much disintegrations per second per liter you have. You know, so fish may be, if you had 30 becquerels per cubic meter when you factor everything in. You know, fish could be maybe, you know, 2 or 3 becquerels per kilogram of weight wet, fresh tissue. That would be almost impossible to detect with just the standard instruments. People try different things to do that, but those little levels usually require more sophisticated processing of tissues and analysis on instruments where you can actually look at the very low levels. And when you look commercially at the labs, you know, 1 becquerel per kilogram may be their minimal detectable level. And the few samples I've seen, there are just a few samples. Some of the commercial seafood sampling commercial companies have run their own analysis at commercial labs. The tuna that you mentioned, you know, you're looking down in the 1 to 2 becquerels per kilogram range.
I see.
So you're looking at, you're not going to just pick that up on the Geiger counter.
Yeah. And I understand that the fish actually metabolize. In the case of the cesium, it doesn't stick around all that long.
No, generally, and all these assumptions that people make are on for uptake are based upon an equilibrium condition where you have this level in the water, the fish lives in there, the level doesn't change, and they come to a balance between excreting and intaking the radionuclides. If you have the levels constantly changing, then it's much more dynamic in the fish to pick it up and lose it for that. And you know, so right now, when you look at the Canadians on the line P, which is an oceanographic line coming out of Canada, you know, their samples are showing, you know, 0.3 becquerels per cubic meter, disintegrations per cubic meter, 4 cesium 137, really low. And they think maybe they're detecting the front of the plume that's coming over from Japan, starting to see an increase, and yet the levels are still much below what Rossi's modeled, which has the higher level of 20 to 30 becquerels reported potentially to be coming. Very, very low levels, tough to detect. Even with sophisticated equipment, you may be sampling the water, you may sample 20 liters, you may sample 100 liters, you know, roughly 30 gallons or a little more. So you're going to sample a lot of water, and then you're going to have to put that through a filtering setup that then tries to remove just the cesium in that amount of water into a very small thimble of material and then analyze that. And in the cases of the University of Hawaii, who's doing some of this work too, as well as Woods Hole, you pretty well press up against detection levels for cesium-137. So it's a big, the unknown right now is the models have predicted, as high as 30 to 35 becquerels per cubic meter. They haven't fully taken in, say, the wide range of assumptions about what was released, but they've taken in what was felt to be the most reasonable range of release of cesium-137. But you don't have actual good data off of the West Coast to get back to people and say, here's what the actual levels are. Currently what we see in seafood predicted on the models, yeah, there's no reason not to consume seafood off of Alaska, off of the West Coast. But you would like to have, yes, here's the actual data that shows these are the levels in the fish, these are the levels in the water, the seafood you're interested in, and they are not showing up as a concern, at least as far as, you know, EPA standards, Food and Drug Administration standards. People may disagree with those standards, and that's, you know, part of everyone's right to look at them and determine do they agree with the standards that are used in the different countries.
Well, Doug Dasher, if you were still at DEC, would you be advising the commissioner that Alaska should have its own monitoring program for Fukushima? Because right now it really doesn't.
Well, there's two things. Yeah, I mean, I do believe there should be monitoring for Fukushima. They obviously have looked at the cost issues. They currently are not equipped or have the equipment in place to do any type of, you know, fish monitoring for radionuclides. At this time, that's, you know, one of the problems is you don't have the equipment in place.
And well, don't you have a lab there? Wait a second.
Yeah, I mean, we have a small lab at the university that consists of the equipment that we got from the Air Force when they moved out of Eielson. And we can test a small amount of samples. But if you came in and said, we want to do the mercury program for, you know, sampling mercury in fish tissue and sample 50 or 100 samples a year for very low levels, we're not necessarily equipped to handle that and try to work with the North Slope Borough right now and sample their subsistence.
I see. There's a capacity issue there.
Yeah, the throughput. And then we typically, the thing we're faced with, too, is you need a full-time technician on the processing. I'm not, you know, full-time for doing radionuclides. I'm actually working other projects. So it's similar to, you know, with the University of California. And other ones, they catch as they can, and yeah, we can do a few samples. But to take on a large major sampling program, you know, you need more support. You need, you know, staff to do that, freezer space to handle all the samples that come in for that. And it's one thing. And then there's the issue of, you know, DEC could wind up, you know, say, do buy all this equipment, get things set up, but there's a lead time in ordering and purchasing equipment, then getting staff to be out and analyzing and running things, whereas the other flip side of the coin is, you know, the federal government. You know, there's a big question. Who has responsibility for the marine environment around the coast of the United States for radionuclides? And if you track what's been happening at Woods Hole, elsewhere, is basically there's not a federal agency that stepped up to the plate and said, yes, we have the responsibility to analyze for radionuclides in the marine environment around the United States.
Excellent point.
That's a big one. So partly DEC is probably saying, well, gee, the feds really should be doing this, and they're more equipped, and they have all these national labs. But, you know, no one has stepped up, and then no one has said, the other side of the coin is, you know, when you talk to them, too, is, well, yeah, we could set that back up. They, you know, had larger programs back in the 60s and 70s where they actually were funded. And they said, but then we've got to either drop something that we're doing, or does, you know, is there going to be any funding put in the budget to actually do this program where we're taking ships offshore and sampling, where we're bringing in, you know, the other second one, it's the Food and Drug Administration, I know, is considering, and I don't think they've finalized anything yet, but they are considering sampling seafood caught along the West Coast in the coming year. They're discussing that aspect. Right now they're just sampling seafood from, you know, the Japan that's coming over.
Well, I have to say, Doug, it all sounds a little sleepy to me, to tell you the truth.
You know, it's one of the difficulties, but that's the first thing. Is, yeah,
I understand what you're talking about. Like, you get a lot of front-end stuff in order to really get anywhere with any of this. But I'm just thinking there must be maybe commercial outfits or something in the lower 48 that processors who want to protect the reputation of their seafood might want to, you know, send a sample and go ahead and put the bill to... You know, to get that,
we got
one becquerel, yeah. It's just like the other ones.
There are several that Vital Foods and I think Loki Foods, Seafoods, have their own line. You know, if you look online, there are several at least two companies that are sending in and reporting results for seafood samples that they pull off their production line.
Yeah, I think we should stress right here that nobody's found any problem.
Yeah, I mean, the levels are, you know, they found reports of, you'll see one or two, you know, 1.4 becquerels per kilogram. You'll see that the state of Washington took a few samples. They got, you know, two samples of albacore tuna before and after Fukushima, and then they've done a couple of salmon. Again, they have at least a laboratory down there at the state of Washington that is set up to do gamma analysis. It's full-time funding, and it's through Hanford. But they did pull a few samples in and had those run. Again, limited number. You know, they've had to run all their Hanford samples, so they haven't been doing a whole lot, but they did run a few samples down there. And that's one concern I know the public has is, well, who's doing the sampling and how many samples and how do you know who sent it in and where it came from? And what condition was it in, and was it big or small fish, and you know,
all those.
With no coordinated program, and that's one thing that I do feel that would help would be if, and there is somewhat of an effort going towards this, but if the states, Alaska environmental agencies, health, could work together in helping move something forward where, yeah, sample results were collected and results were posted as to what levels they were getting, how much sampling was going on, and to help get a coordinated, you know, effort. There's Woods Hole is sampling more in the, you know, further over towards Japan. University of Hawaii is doing partway in the North Pacific. Occasionally they'll get some samples from a cruise and report on that. So there are some people trying to track this plume front as it moves towards, but it's all, you know, not haphazard, but it's definitely not a coordinated effort.
And spotty, yeah.
That. And yeah. So you don't get that confidence that, yeah, it's being well-tracked, we know what's happening, and we can answer the public's concerns and provide the data.
Thanks for that very honest answer and assessment there, Dr. Doug Dasher, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about radiation from Fukushima. Well, most of the radiation was released in the atmosphere. There is continuing some release into the ocean. It's extremely diluted, and so diluted it's extremely hard to detect. We have with us Doug Dasher, who's environmental oceanographer at UAF, and Thomas joins the program from Butte. Thomas, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
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 Well, my concern is not only for myself, but for the people that rely on the ocean for their meals continuously. They don't all have Happy Meals as an option. And, you know, it's fish in the morning and then fish in the afternoon, and then we have fish for dinner, and so there, you know, you have what they're saying is it's a little bit here, but they're eating lots and lots of little bits. And at what point is it not safe to feed to the children?
For that, and yeah, I understand your concern definitely, and that's one of the issues with knowing what the levels actually are in the fish. Rather than, you know, we can look at the model and say, you know, based upon the model, we don't see a risk that's outside of the, you know, EPA. EPA has a range that they use from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in a million.
Based on the initial eruption and the leaks, it's like a pinball machine game where every day there is a new top score, and the numbers keep going up. And they're totally clueless on how they're going to stop this. And they're saying, you know, 40 years, 100 years. And if we, you know, you keep adding just a little bit every year, seems to me that would add up to be a lot. And I can't think of the name of the species, but sardines or Yeah, sardines. They crashed this year, and
yeah, in California. Yep.
Yeah, and lots of you know, food. The food chain is breaking, and if it, you know, and they say, oh, it's not related to Fukushima, real confidently, but they don't know what it's related to, and I see that the food chain's breaking down, and you know, maybe the fish is still safe to eat today. What about 20 years from now? And I think that we need to be preparing for that eventuality, having our victory gardens growing and such like that, rather than, you know, just rely on President Obama's initial statement that no radiation is going to hit the United States and you can go out and play. And I was 4 in 64 when China blew off the bomb, and my mother, she wouldn't let me outside, and there was no milk. And she explained this to me as a four-year-old, and so when this happened, I stayed inside. I cut back on my milk. And then I see the people out there, they're mowing the grass with no filters on their face. And I'm concerned that, you know, they're just getting a little bit all day long, every day, with all the dust and the filth. And I've seen the kids cleaning up the garbage after the snow, where the and they were in the piles where the snow plows had plowed it up into big hills, and the snow had melted and there was garbage in it, and they had the children picking the garbage out of those things with no gloves. And I told the lady, They should have, you know, plastic gloves on. And she got real angry at me and told me to move on, that she's got this under control. And I don't think that we're preparing as it continues to just leak, like, terribly. They've got no grasp on it. And then they built the wall that... to keep the water, underground dam to keep the water from flowing into the ocean. And so now the site is filling up with water, and Unit 4 is in precarious condition with the fuel storage pool up with thousands of tons sitting on the seventh floor, which is a crazy thing. And
all right, Thomas. You have genuine concerns.
Yeah.
There's a cumulative concern. I would say, just, you know, factually, that the release into the water is much less than it was.
Yeah,
I mean, in terms of continuous release, but I mean, not that it's not a concern, and the cumulative is always a concern.
Yeah, I think there's two things. There's definitely the initial release is still substantially higher than what is being reported. And now these are all gross estimates, of course, that people have and what's actually leaking, because of difficulty making the measurements of what's currently leaking. So it's a much lower rate coming into the environment right now for that. So even though it will attach and move into the plume, the material is decaying as it moves towards the U.S. and also being removed into deeper waters at the same time for that. But definitely your concern, I can see on, yeah, there's a lot of unknowns about, you know, what's going to happen at the plant, how they're going to stop these leaks, how they're going to handle the spent fuel rods, which they're working on, how they're going to handle the melted core, how much of the core was melted, where it is. There's a huge number of technical issues that they, you know, as far as I know, don't have real answers for right now, and can raise a lot of different guesses and scenarios of, well, what would happen if this happened in the future, and we don't know.
Well, Thomas also said, look, I remember my mom from back in the 60s and the strontium 90 and Dr. Sternglass and all that. She made me come inside, and now I came inside when I found out about this, and I was concerned about what might have been piling up in the snow, and then the kids playing in the snow, and maybe it's further concentrating. And he's saying, and then we learned, there actually was a substantial atmospheric release. A lot of it ended up dropping over water, but still, you know, it wasn't as, he was not being as alarmist as many people might have thought he was.
Yeah, I mean, the issue, in the, especially in the first part of the release with iodine-131, you know, along the West Coast, you know, the concern there and, you know, how that was addressed. But, and in milk, you mentioned milk, and that was one of the big things in the 60s with iodine-131 being picked up from the grass, concentrated in the milk, was, and they had a much more massive sampling program. I know they did some milk sampling in the lower 48 after Fukushima. I'm not aware of, you know, how much, but nothing like, of course, what occurred in the 60s there. Currently, though, the atmospheric release, continuing atmospheric release, isn't a concern. I know people have concerns about, well, what's in the snow melt, what comes down, what's in the dust. And for that, the only group that says to this consistent monitoring is it's going to be with the EPA RadNet for what they pick up on their filters in their different stations that they have in the lower 48. And I know there's, you know, they have their problems with the stations and run in, but they're, you know, the only one that's actually collecting data on particulates regularly under standardized program in the United States right now to look at that. But I think the main concern is, you know, this continuing release and what is that going to do? What will that do over time? You know, right now, a lot of people, it's stated, was the levels being released are much lower than the initial release, but no one knows, you know, what's going to happen over time. Are they going to get them fixed so they're no longer releasing next year? Or are they going to run 20 years, 30 years? You know, there's all sorts of all over the board projection-wise.
Thomas, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your call there from Butte and that very well-expressed concern that you have. And we turn now to Tom, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call. See, I think we should be asking our government what they're doing about hardening the electrical grid. If we lose our electrical grid, we have meltdown in all those power plants worldwide, and it needs to be a worldwide.
Tom, I was thinking you might call about this one.
Yeah, and we need a worldwide effort to get rid of those power plants and nuclear bombs. And Alaska needs to develop in a manner that doesn't shorten our existence on the planet. And fossil fuel is the problem. We need a worldwide effort on this thing. We need to help Japan in lieu of suing them. We're suing them now instead of helping them. And that should change. It needs to be a worldwide effort.
Tom, thank you. Thank you, as always, for your call. And to Matt now in Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Matt.
Hey, hi, Steve. Thank you. I've got one question and one comment. The question is, what's the measurable difference in this nuclear, I forget the phrase, versus normal background?
Oh, well, he did mention that, but it doesn't hurt to do it again. It's very small in relation to background. It's very hard to pull out of background.
Yeah, the thing is, I think this is an important thing for Alaska fish marketing.
Yes.
You recall what happened with the Exxon Valdez, you know, the entire market for all of Alaska salmon and other fish was affected by the Exxon Valdez, even though, you know, they might have been 500, 800 miles away. The Alaska market was still affected. And I think that the state should be proactive on this because I see I'm hearing a lot of stuff down from the lower 48 about, oh, you can't eat Alaska fish because of radiation, and I don't think it's based on any factual thing.
It's not based on anything, any actual radiation that anybody's found. Let's put it that way, Matt.
Yeah, but it's going to be a real thing in the marketplace.
And that's one of the reasons that I was really interested to do this program because it does seem that maybe there needs to be some authority that steps forward and says, look, this is the way things are.
Yeah,
we can go check these numbers out because I'm the kind of guy, I need to read things and digest it.
Doug Dasher, where could Matt go to see the relationship between the background and what they've been able to detect?
for that. I mean, I would go Woods Hole has put up very good graphical representations and discussions on their website of the different levels they're observed in the environment and background for the naturally occurring materials, too, for that. And you would just have to Google Woods Hole and Fukushima, but Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute.
Yeah,
and Ken
Bussler.
Ken Bussler.
Yeah.
They've got they've had the time to get their website designers together and put some very good information, you know, out on the website there, and they're probably the most current. There's other things like the Art Nuclear Waste Assessment Program, and they used to have the information on the web, but that's years ago, and of course hasn't been. It's probably still out there, but hasn't been maintained since then. But the Woods Hole, EPA has some very good guidelines on discussing the different radiation levels and background radiation for that. But I do agree that, you know, being proactive carries a lot of benefits, and that's what, you know, I always would recommend that the state of Alaska look at, is being able to help people understand and show them what the levels are, especially when you deal with commercial seafood and subsistence foods. Are critical to give people confidence. You don't want people to stop eating subsistence foods that are beneficial when the observed levels in that, if any, in the foods show that they are not a health risk.
I noticed here on the web, before we take our second break here, I noticed here on the web a X-ray technologist who posted a comment and said, look, I bought a radiation detector and I measure my food. And if I don't buy any food that measures over 100, the danger level, background radiation is 45 in California, and I will never eat anything out of the Pacific Ocean again. I don't care what anybody else does. I can't imagine what kind of detector would she have that would have these numbers on it, and what would those numbers mean?
Well, those are counts per second or counts per minute if it's a typical Geiger counter. And, yeah, I've seen nothing indicated. 45 is a background for any certain area in California. It may be at that house at that location. You can see background vary quite a bit depending upon where you are. If you're next to bedrock, above bedrock, what type of soil you're on, how your house is made, concrete or not concrete, be in the basement, be in the attic. Levels will vary in food types depending on how much potassium 40 they may have in the food, naturally occurring radionuclide there. So, yeah, establishing exactly what a background for the state is, a whole range of levels for that.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks, Doug Dasher. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing radiation from Fukushima. And it's turned to seafood rather quickly. Bill joins the program now from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Several of your speakers have referred to this well. The primary confusion in the public now, I think, is between what has happened and the radiation that's migrating its leisurely way across the Pacific and the dangers of what might happen in the future. And there are three primary ones, as folks have referred to them. There's the spent fuel, which has to be removed safely over probably a period of years. And that can, in a number of ways, result in very, very damaging releases of radiation if those fuel rods are damaged or catch fire. Secondly, the melted reactors, corium they call it, are migrating who knows where in the ground and encountering groundwater, which then is going to contaminate flow of fresh water into the Pacific. And third, the next earthquake, whenever it is, however big it is likely to cause destruction there, which may result in even more radiation release. If you look at a Google Earth photo of that site, you'll see about 100 tanks on the southwest side of the main plant. We don't know what those hold. It may be radioactive water, pending treatment or some other form of disposal, and an earthquake could possibly damage several or all of those and release whatever they're holding. So TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company that's apparently in charge of this, may simply be in over their heads financially and technically. And because this has worldwide implications for health and safety, it needs to have a worldwide solution to it. So we need to find out, A, what's really the situation there? How difficult is it? What kind of help do they need? This is really an unprecedented situation. You have to be sympathetic with these folks. And there are limits to what TEPCO can afford. They may be on the brink of running over their budget or even bankruptcy. So it's the future problems that are far greater than what we're experiencing and expected to experience now.
Well, here's hoping it doesn't continue to become a worse catastrophe, Bill. But I think we're, you know, it's a matter of political leverage to get there from here. Thanks for bringing those concerns up. Doug Dasher?
Bill, I appreciate those concerns and hear them quite a bit. But that, I think, brings to point the importance of getting a baseline now with good information, knowing what levels are currently out there, what's coming as well, atmospherically as well as in the marine environment, so that if something does happen, we can identify it, and we can identify where there may be areas that are vulnerable to increased levels. If the levels do increase due to some additional problems in the future, we would then be able to look at the critical areas that need to either have sampling or have limits placed on them. We would know that, and it's basically a vulnerability assessment, which is used in Europe to look at where should we look, at what levels do we start to say, okay, we need to watch this particular area, particular food source. And that's why the baselines are also very critical, because of the potential things that may happen in the future. Hopefully they won't. Hopefully, you know, things will get more under control. But without that baseline to assess things, it really hurts if something happens.
Yeah, thank you.
But appreciate your concern.
Bill, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go now to Dave, joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks a lot for getting this show up. By the way, the companies that tested those fish, Vital Choice is the name of one of them, as well as Loki Seafoods. And that the link is available to that via kplu.org if people want to read that article.
And good old KPLU. Thanks for that.
Yeah, the thing I'd like to sort of throw out for, I believe it was the first caller, was talking about the ecosystem breaking down. The sardines, you know, they will disappear like that. This is something that happens with decadal oscillation. It happens with El Nino, La Nina, depending on the conditions. So it's not really fair to just get a general feeling of gloom and despair on this. And the starfish, you know, that wasting disease, that's happening on the East Coast too. It's not just the West Coast phenomenon. And I don't think we should unnecessarily go off the deep end. I mean, we face some very, very difficult things here with this Fukushima, but I don't think we need to add to the general, if not paranoia, hysteria. It's just too many things we don't know and how things work. And I guess just one last thing is that those fish that were tested by Vital Choice and Loki were Alaskan salmon. So, by the by, thanks a lot for the great show.
Okay, Dave. Yeah, we're all doing the best we can. I know Doug has been hugely overbooked, so I really appreciate him being willing to come on the show. I've tried to get Bussler for years. No, seriously, for years. And he's awful busy, too. Let's go to Jack, joins the program from Point Hope. Point Hope. Does that ring a bell there, Doug?
Yeah, I'm back in Project Chariot.
Right. Jack, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
When that thing came on TV, I went ahead and I had some equipment with me. And so I kind of monitored it just to see what would happen. At the same time, there was this German website that was monitoring 131 and 137. The 131 is the short-lived one for, you know, easy tracking. And so the pattern went straight across to California, up to, you know, the other two states, Oregon and Washington State, went up to the Canadian border, and then hit Kertowick, Barrow, Wainwright, and Point Hope. So it happened on the 11th, and it hit us on the 24th. I only got about 150 counts above background with a scintillation counter with a 3-inch crystal. And so that's more or less what I saw. And then after 2 weeks, they, you know, quit monitoring it because, you know, the jet stream and the magnetics had caused all the mixing, so you really couldn't track it, per se. And so it goes. And anyway, I went ahead and analyzed some seal meat and some Ugruk bearded seal, dried. And I didn't get very much readings. So I didn't notice anything, even though my instrument is 1,000 times more sensitive. My sister also sent me some seaweed from Southeast Alaska, and I didn't see anything above background too, and that was this summer, this fall. And so, you know, based on what was, you know, put on the internet and on those social websites like Facebook and such, you know, it was really interesting to see all of the scare that was going on, but I didn't notice any changes that were, that, you know, from where we're at.
Jack, thank you so much for your call.
I've been watching that, I will continue to do that. So, but, you know, I didn't have a shield, so I don't have real accurate, and I haven't met the protocols, per se. And that's more or less what had happened in regards to our situation.
You have the technology. Jack, thanks for that call. Doug Dasher.
Yeah, thanks, Jack.
That's going to pretty well end the show right now, but we'll stay in touch.
Okay. Okay, well, appreciate being invited.
All right. Thank you very much. Our guests have been Doug Dasher, environmental researcher, University of Alaska, Fairbanks. And I want to thank the crew, Dave Waldwell. Well, Dave Waldron's not with us. Kristen and Monica. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.